Hello. Welcome to the third episode in our mini-series on Richard Blanchard. In this episode, we focus on some of the key factors that influenced the colonization of Vancouver Island, including the little-known 1858 Parliamentary Commission into Blanchard, Indigenous-settler relations in a time of political and economic uncertainty, the diminishing regional dominance of the Hudson's Bay Company, and more. We hope you enjoy, and now on to the third part of our Richard Blanchard series.
In 1857, there was a parliamentary inquiry in London at the Houses of Parliament by a committee of the House of Commons, which was to investigate the circumstances of what had gone on or what was going on in Vancouver Island as a colony, because its progress had been so paltry and so slow. And the other thing was, they were also wanting to evaluate to see if the Hudson Bay Company was doing successful business in the Northwest Territories from Manitoba all the way up to the mouth of the Mackenzie River. So Blanchard, who had been governor here 1851, and who had gone home ill and had asked to be relieved of his duties, and his resignation was accepted. He was very apprehensive about the nature of United States aggression, because he knew that the wars of the American authorities, or the United States authorities on the one hand, and the various Indian nations on the other, was a constant feature of the southern frontier south of the 49th parallel. The committee was interested in this question. What was the difference? What was the difference in the local administration on British soil? Blanchard answered the question. He explained that the indigenous people had no objection to hiring themselves out as laborers to the Hudson Bay Company, and in fact were very useful in the building of trading posts. They gathered coal and did lumber work. He left no impression with the committee that the indigenous people were a hindrance to colonization. When one committee member asked, so far as there being an obstruction to colonization, you think that they would be an assistance? And Blanchard replied simply, yes. If the committee were trying to get an expose on HBC Indian policy, they did not receive it from the former governor. In fact, there was no reason for him to change his views. He regarded the indigenous peoples as kindly treated by the Hudson Bay Company. The reason for that is, as I have spoken elsewhere, was the trading and supply arrangements that kept them in a situation of peace. Furthermore, as to the economic dependencies developed, he had noted that indigenous laborers were hired and they worked in the economic pursuits of the colony, in the company's interest and apparently to their own. All during the inquiry, many strong opinions were expressed regarding the ill fortunes of Vancouver Island. And when on the 31st of July of 1857, the Select Committee's of Parliament's report was published, it was no surprise to interested parties in Britain, or in Vancouver Island for that matter, or Red River, or Canada, to read the following. Your committee are of opinion that it will be proper to terminate the connection of the Hudson Bay Company with Vancouver Island as soon as it can conveniently be done, as the best means of favoring the development of the great natural advantages of that important colony. Means should also be provided for the ultimate extension of the colony over a portion of the adjoining continent to the west of the Rocky Mountains, on which permanent settlement may be found practical. Can we uncouple this for a minute, please? First of all, it says, it should be done immediately. There's no if, muts, or musts, or buts, or maybe on that score. It's the planned extension of the colony to include the mainland, as we islanders sometimes call it. That is to say, the colony of British Columbia is established 1858, the following year after this report was proclaimed, I should point out. That should be done also to consolidate British holdings west of the Rocky Mountains, on which permanent settlement may be found practicable. It doesn't say to keep the United States or the Americans out. What it does say that permanent settlement should be found and established in that area. So settlement under the Crown is seen as the best means of defense. Well, the Hudson Bay Company was agreeable to this arrangement. And in point of fact, they said, yes, we'll gladly do that. But first of all, we got to agree on the terms of it. Now, I've said before that this was an informal empire of immense proportions. And the Hudson Bay Company had properties in Victoria, in Langley, in Port Simpson, Nanaimo and its coal mines, and other locations. It had properties, it had invested in roads and surveying and so forth. They wanted compensation for this. The British government had no problem with that. The Brits were of the essence, thinking of the essence that property was to be respected. So if the Hudson Bay Company said, we want our possessory rights to be compensated for, that's fine. So it took quite some time, till 1869, until finally the final figure was finally agreed on. The HBC grossed up their total that they claimed, and the colonial office kept beating and knocking them down. And finally, the final figure was achieved and paid out by the Crown to the HBC as compensation for their imperial investment. So it's not as if one imperial phase ends as a failure. The Hudson Bay Company's made all its money out of this. It's, even though they're not continued in their license, even though they've been bought out, nonetheless, they still share in the profits. Well, this goes on into other parts of Canada, as we know. The report pointed the way to a possible colony of British Columbia. Further, if a link could come from the east, an expansion of Canada to Red River and beyond, that would be wonderful. The company, for the time being, was allowed to maintain its territorial rights in those parts of Rupert's Land and the Indian Territories. It offered a little prospect for permanent settlement. But change was in the air, and the American belief in its own master destiny arose again. In 1868, the Rupert's Land Act was passed by the Imperial Parliament, authorizing the acquisition of Canada of the Northwest Territories. That would comprise Rupert's Land and the areas beyond. And in consequence, the whole of Rupert's Land in 1870 passed to the Canadian government for the cost of £300,000. This surely ranks as the most extraordinary real estate deals in history. But do you follow my arguments here? We've got compensation for imperial investments. The British want to get Rupert's Land and the Northwest Territories out of their own direct hands. And so the compensation of the Hudson Bay Company is paid out. And furthermore, the Northwest Territories in 1880 is fully transferred. All the Arctic claims of the Canadian North pass to Canada from Great Britain. That's the land of the Northwest Passage. And of course, the water ways, of course, are international waterways at that time. So the whole change occurs Now, you may have said, well, what about Louis Riel? Well, what about Louis Riel? He has been, and his people, the Métis of Red River, have been totally ignored in this arrangement. And this is the reason for the rising that occurs. And then the counter march that's led by Colonel Wolsey that arrives to put down the rebellion. But that's how Manitoba comes into existence as a province, and why Louis Riel is proclaimed the father of Manitoba. Oh, I think that's a bit of a stretch. But in any event, these transactions were occurring. These are British transactions. They have very little to do with United States history, but the United States and its manifest destiny and its desires are always in the background, always in the background. And the frontier wars are always in the background as well. For instance, in Minnesota in 1864 was the Minnesota-Dakota Rising. And you know what the United States did to that? They killed 364 Blackfeet in Minnesota to put down that rising. That's how they were dealing with this sort of thing. And there was movements in Congress and in the press to go north to the North Pole, and Canada could be easy pickings. But the Americans and the American peoples and governments misunderstood the nature of the British Empire and its countervailing possibilities. No, without a doubt, then, it was the problem of Vancouver Island that needed immediate attention. The Parliamentary Committee was thorough in calling and interrogating witnesses in this regard. And one of these was Captain James Cooper, who I will close with in this little discussion of this problem. He was a friend of Richard Blanchard's. Richard Blanchard had brought him onto the Provisional Council when Blanchard had left for home. And James Cooper, a mariner, an inveterate free trader, an opponent of the Hudson Bay Company, though he had previously been in Hudson Bay Company employ, he gave his evidence to the Parliamentary Committee in 1857. And because the committee was interested in the role of law in British Columbia, Vancouver Island, and so forth, Cooper made it quite clear that the hanging of an Indigenous person in British territories, such as in Vancouver, was an executive power. It came fully under the power of a governor. Murder or manslaughter was dealt with by the governor and not by a civil judge. Judge Cameron, when he comes out here as the Chief Justice, acts only in civil cases. And it's not until, of course, in the colony of British Columbia that Judge Begbie comes out, and he has that executive power, which was previously under the control of the governor. I think it's important to note, when you look at James Cooper's evidence, that he fully backs and fully supports the position that Governor Blanchard had taken out here, that the Hudson Bay Company was opposed to settlement. It did nothing to encourage settlement. That in point of fact, it didn't want settlement. It wanted to maintain the old order of the fur trade. The old order of the fur trade was predicated on the close arrangement with the Indigenous peoples. The Indigenous peoples didn't want settlement either, or if settlers did come, they were liable to be picked off or piracy would occur. So going back to one of the things I said in an earlier episode, that William Muir Gladstone said that the Hudson Bay Company was an anti-colonizing agency, it's absolutely true, and this is demonstrated by the facts. So we have, in conclusion, in the Vancouver Island story, a completely different set of circumstances than what happens in the Gold Rush colony of British Columbia. I haven't gone into the coal mining business at Fort Rupert at Suquash and at Nanaimo. That's another part of the story that occurs from 1850 to 1853 and after. And that is an industrial eruption that changes very dramatically the history of Vancouver Island. But in terms of settlement then, Vancouver Island was a very retarded place for settlers, but it was a very powerfully growing and very active place for commerce, for seaborne commerce. And that, after all, had been the intention of the Hudson Bay Company, to develop the coastal trade and to make its profits for its shareholders, which was the nature of empire as they saw it.